So we plunge from a bright, if bloody, history into a dark and bloody future. I cannot help this private pessimism. The sun shines in many places, but this continent seems to be declining into a long winter, and all our strength and all our warm tradition may not be enough to hold it back. We've become a nation of awful paradox. Hysteria inlaid with unconcern, literacy woven with misconception, democracy wrapped up in tyranny, boldness nailed down by fear. I have no doubt of the outcome, but I dread the interval.
Those words may sound very current now, conveying as they do a sense of anxiety about the political climate. But they were written by Connie Converse in 1950. Connie Converse was a very interesting, thoughtful person who wrote some interesting, thoughtful, and sometimes funny songs back in the 1950s. Her work never had much exposure and was entirely forgotten until I helped bring some public attention to it several years ago now. The previous Spinning on Air podcast, episode 4, tells the story of Connie Converse, the composer, the person who tried to have her music heard in the world, whose work wasn't appreciated, and who ultimately decided to leave the life she had and just disappear, which she did in 1974, gone without a trace. Or maybe she did leave, at least a trace. The focus of my first telling of Connie Converse's story was her music, but there are other aspects to her life that add really important dimension to her story. I recently looked into things that I haven't seen covered anywhere else. Her activism, her work with organizations that were targeted by the FBI and the House Un-American Activities Committee for supposed connections to the Soviet KGB. Her extensive work as a writer and editor on peace and conflict resolution issues, and her life in Ann Arbor, Michigan during the culturally and politically turbulent and exciting 1960s. I'll tell you what I discovered. You'll hear some old and new performances of Connie's songs. You'll hear some of Connie's writings read by Amber Benson, as they were just now. And you'll hear from Riley Trumbull, who knew Connie in the 1960s, and whose life intersected with Connie's in some fascinating ways.
You know, she did a really horrible thing to me at one point, and not because she was a mean and horrible person, but because she was trying to be a very good person.
To play a record also by a woman singer, getting off the track of my pure New Orleans style jazz.
Academy Award winning animator Gene Deitch on Spinning on Air in 2004.
As the word got around that I had a tape recorder, all kinds of people would show up who wanted to get recorded. And a woman showed up, and I can't remember exactly how we met her, how she came, but she showed up at our house in one of our sessions once with her guitar, a very modest young woman. She went by the name Connie Converse, and she wrote beautiful, poignant songs and sang them in such a way that they just melted your heart. And we all fell in love with her music, even though it was out of the context of pure jazz or pure blues or anything. These were pure songs. But she was way ahead of her time. She was a poet and a very fascinating character, a woman who I think had a lot of frustrations in her life. She never was able to realize any success with her songs. Many of us have tried every which way to get her songs before the public. I'm going to give one new chance here through the courtesy of Dave Garland and play one of the recordings that I made of her in the mid-50s, 1954, and see if you don't think this is a beautiful song. This is really a lost genius.
We go walking in the dark. We go walking out at night. And it's not as well.
Interesting. I listened to one of her songs and it was really, really strange because that is the voice I know. And it just came hauntingly back. It was a little bit disconcerting. I really think that the memory that we use every day is one thing, but that other memory, voice context, a smell of something, a temperature in a certain shade or light, very much more compelling, I think, probably more accurate, too.
Riley Trumbull in a recent interview. And before that, Jean Deitch introducing the music of Connie Converse, introducing the world to her music, trying one more time to encourage some interest in her work. This time it caught on. And we heard Jean's recording, which he had made 50 years prior, of Connie Converse singing her song One by One. Connie surely loved making music, and surely she was discouraged that when she was writing music, it wasn't widely heard, and when it was heard, it was underappreciated. But she had other passions and pursuits as well. She was born Elizabeth Eaton Converse in Laconia, New Hampshire, August 3, 1924. Her brother Philip said she didn't like the name Elizabeth. Connie became her nickname when she lived in New York City. Her father was a minister, and according to the Nashua, New Hampshire Telegraph of 1948, he was the superintendent of the New Hampshire Christian Civic League and its predecessor, the New Hampshire Anti-Saloon League, for over 23 years. Connie had two brothers, a younger brother, Philip, and an older brother, Paul. She was at the top of her class at Concord High School in Concord, New Hampshire. Her valedictorian speech at the 1942 graduation was followed by a ceremony in which a lot of honors and awards were distributed to the seniors. Connie's brother Philip recalled in a biographical essay that about a dozen honors were given for the most this, the best that, etc. There were cheers when Connie won the first of those awards. And then she won another, and another. And Philip said that the audience tittered and groaned. And by the time she was called up to receive her eighth award, the audience was noisy and the groans had it, said Philip. Their parents, he wrote, ended up more embarrassed than proud and slunk off home as rapidly as possible. Philip Converse, himself surely one of the most important social scientists of the 20th century, according to a colleague, wrote that Sis was a genius and a polymath. I do not use the terms lightly. Connie was a poet, a writer of scholarly articles, a cartoonist, a painter, a would-be novelist by her own description, an activist, a sculptor, and among still other things, a songwriter. In fact, she may be one of the first singer-songwriters, as we understand that term now, someone who expresses a personal view and understanding of the world by creating both words and music in song. She wrote most of her songs between 1950 and 1955, when she was in her late 20s living in New York City. Some of the songs evoke that period, but all have as well a timeless quality because of their balance of invention and simplicity, their honesty, their earnestness and wit, their curiosity about how a song can fit together, and their sense of necessity. You can feel that while these songs were made playfully, they were also a lifeline, a reaching out from the heart. Connie's mother and her mother's mother both graduated from Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. And after her illustrious high school career, Connie herself received a full scholarship to Mount Holyoke in 1942. Later, she listed as an office held that of class song leader, 1942-43.
People say a roving woman is likely not to be better than she ought to be. So when I stray away from where I've got to be, someone always takes me home. A lady never should habituate saloons, and that is where I find myself on many afternoons. But just as I begin to blow away the foam, someone tips his hat to me and takes me home. People say a gambling woman.
That's a little portion of Connie's song, Roving Woman. In an introduction to it, Connie wrote, "The story takes place during the Puritan Rebellion of 1947. She's probably referring to her own rebellion against her New England upbringing and influences like her father's anti-saloon league. After just 2 years at college, where she was first in her class, the most accomplished student, she dropped out to her family's dismay. She moved to New York City in 1945, maybe feeling the shift in culture and politics with the end of World War II, maybe to pursue her songwriting in a cultural capital, but also, at some point, Connie had developed a passion for politics, a fascination with policy and how choices were made, and she wanted to get involved and make a difference. I don't think she considered running for office, but she did do some writing for some policy journals, both early in her career and later in her life. I've uncovered some interesting things about Connie Converse, the activist, and the impetus for sort of re-examining her story was the invitation to write some liner notes for an album of Connie's songs that are performed by contemporary artists. This was produced by John Zorn for his label Zodic, and that album, Vanity of Vanities, is available now with my extensive liner notes included and a lot of great performances. Here's a portion of one of those new performances of Connie's music. This is by Aaron Dyer. You may know her from the band Buke and Gace, and Greg Saunier, drummer of the band Deerhoof. They collaborated on this arrangement of Connie's Playboy of the Western World.
Buffalo was never sufficiently gilded and pearled, and this man turned out to be the playboy of the Western world. Oh, he was elegant past all dreaming. He made seem
and the world was green again without him, again without him. For he was elegant, past all dreaming. He makes seeming seem like the real McCoy.
Aaron Dyer and Greg Saunier. Portion of their version of Playboy of the Western World by Connie Converse. From the Zadok CD, Vanity of Vanities. A lot of other good performers on that too. Laurie Anderson, Karen O, Jesse Harris, Petra Hayden, Martha Wainwright, and others. You'll find a link to more information about it at spinningonair.org. Around 1974, when Connie was living in Ann Arbor, Michigan, friends pooled money to provide her with what they called an award in recognition of her unique contributions to scholarship, education, and human individuality. This was, in effect, a bit of sort of local crowdfunding to help Connie through a difficult time. These people knew Connie, or Elizabeth as they knew her, in a way that hasn't been communicated to us just through her music. They wrote, "Elizabeth has penetrated the barriers that so often separate scholars from activists dedicated to social change. As both a scholar and an activist, she has participated in social movements, or new directions in the social sciences, for peace, for the abolition of racism, for broad political change, for the continuing development of the free individual. She has given generously of her talents in writing, editing, organizing, graphics, and layout, not to mention the inevitable licking of stamps and running of the mimeograph machine. More importantly, she has made systematic intellectual contributions to the thinking of these action programs, which no one else could have provided." Caroline Riley Trumbull, who in the 1960s was married to a man named Milton Cohen and was known as Caroline Cohen, worked with Connie at the Center for Research on Conflict Resolution at the University of Michigan and their publication, The Journal of Conflict Resolution. The journal had been founded by a man named Kenneth Boulding, who with his wife Elise Boulding were prominent activists for peace, known throughout the United States and the world. William Barth, or Bill Barth, also worked on the journal, and a co-worker who was also a personal friend of Connie's, Gay Crouch. Riley Trumbull remembers Connie at that time.
I knew her in the mid and late 60s, and she looked Quakerish and pioneerish. She presented herself as being the activist much more than the musician when I knew her. I was way younger. At the time, it was a gap that made a difference. Now it makes almost no difference.
Hmm. How big a gap was the age difference?
Well, when was she born? I was born in 1940.
She was born in 1924. So,
right. Yeah. So there was that difference. She seemed like a real grown-up to me.
Yeah.
And I seemed like a child to everyone. I was pretty much younger than that crowd of people, but it was a crowd that, I mean, Ken Boulding and Elise, they were, you know, old people, now would seem young, but at the time, definitely old people. And then there was a middle layer of people like Elizabeth and Gay and Bill Barth. And then the tag ends, which would be me and, you know, the younger people who were becoming activists, or, you know, was mostly civil rights at the time, anti-war, and that's the context I knew her in. But every now and then at parties, she would sing, and I thought she was wonderful, and she had an amazing, tricky sense of humor. I was thinking after I heard from you, it's really strange that I can remember that she had this tricky sense of humor, this nature of sense of humor, but I couldn't tell you a single funny thing. I can't remember any of, like, I never can. I mean, can't remember a joke, but I remember laughing.
Yeah.
So I couldn't give you an example, but it was definitely her delivery and her quirky vision, and it was funny to people. People loved it.
Was she sort of understated in her humor?
It was always understated. You know, people talk about dry humor. It wasn't necessarily dry humor, but it was a surprise. It came out of nowhere. It was delivered in the guise of just ordinary words, and then you listened to them, and they were funny, and they made you think about what had been said in a different context. So you're prepared for this kind of joke, but instead you get this one over here. And she didn't, I started to say she didn't laugh a lot. She didn't exactly laugh a lot, but she had a good chuckle, and she was kind of giggly when she was drunk. And I saw a lot of the drinking. It was a time and a crowd of people who did a lot of drinking. And she lived a really simple, frugal life. She lived in a tiny little space. Oh my gosh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize I remembered that. She lived in a small room at one time. I visited her. It was dark. The shades were drawn in the daytime. She was always a sort of a subdued person, except sometimes when drinking, she would be laughing, you know. But I wouldn't call her morose. I think I said to you, sort of mousy, meaning not colorful, not seeking the center stage at all. Always in the background, but not like an apologetic person. I'm not saying that at all. She just didn't need the spotlight, I guess.
In your email, you described her as strategically mousy. What did you mean by that?
I meant that it was her intention not to stand out.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like a kind of a person who is mousy but wished that they could, you know, be the first one on the dance floor.
Uh-huh.
For her, I think she got more done by being in the background a little. She had more control of her environment the way she wanted it when she just stayed kind of in the background. It was like intentionally, yeah.
When Connie Converse dropped out of Mount Holyoke in 1945, she was apparently passionate about politics. She got involved with progressive organizations in the city, including the American Institute for Pacific Relations. And it turned out that this organization, like some of the others she was associated with, were being targeted by the FBI and the House Un-American Activities Committee. After arriving in New York, Connie worked for 5 years, writing and editing at a journal called Far Eastern Survey, which was a publication of the American Institute of Pacific Relations. She specialized in the post-war concerns of Micronesia, in which she apparently made herself an expert. Here's a taste of her writing from an article called The United States as Trustee, Part 2, from Far Eastern Survey, number 24, volume 18, November 30th, 1949.
The ancient practice of colonialism, in which the politics, economics, and society of a dependent people are shaped to fit the needs of the exploiting nation, has been formally disavowed by the trusteeship principles of the United Nations Charter. Where is the sensible mean between wiping out Micronesia's broad cultural identity and preserving the islands as anachronistic museum pieces?
Another journal with similar concerns, Amerasia, was associated with, shared staff, and shared the same building with the Institute of Pacific Relations. Whether or not Connie worked for both journals isn't clear. On June 6, 1945, the FBI arrested Amerasia's editor and some other staff who were suspected of espionage and charged with unauthorized possession of government documents. The Amerasia offices were raided, and 1,700 classified State Department, Navy, OSS, and Office of War Information documents were seized. Charges that the IPR was infiltrated with communists led to congressional hearings and IPR's loss of tax-exempt status. We can be sure that Connie was shaken how close she came to working with any of these documents, or how close she came to being arrested, is something we don't know. But we know that, at least personally, she certainly felt the effects of McCarthyism. In a diary entry from May 3, 1950, she refers to the feature bout of Lattimore versus McCarthy, and this was a reference to Owen Lattimore, who earlier had been the editor of the Institute of Pacific Relations journal Pacific Affairs, who in March 1950 had been accused of being the top Soviet espionage agent in the United States by Senator Joseph McCarthy.
Dear Diary, a long lapse, troubled and hectic times. So we plunge from a bright, if bloody, history into a dark and bloody future. I cannot help this private pessimism. The sun shines in many places, but this continent seems to be declining into a long winter, and all our strength and all our warm tradition may not be enough to hold it back. We've become a nation of awful paradox, hysteria inlaid with unconcern, literacy woven with misconception, democracy wrapped up in tyranny, boldness nailed down by fear. I have no doubt of the outcome, but I dread the interval.
You said that you knew Elizabeth as an activist. What was your impression of her activism and her politics? What were her priorities, and how radical or not radical was she?
Well, her politics were very much on the left, and she was very, very much a peacenik. She was a very peaceful, peace-loving person. She was anti-guns, anti-war. But I would say that she voiced her politics or carried out her politics within this mainstream, this mainframe of conflict resolution. Mm-hmm. She saw these movements as the way to get the kinds of changes that you would have. At the time, I thought I was far more radical than she and far to the left of her. Mm-hmm. Looking back, I don't know that that's true. I can see her very well as being one of those quiet, far left, radical. I could easily see her as a very strong socialist, communist. I don't think so. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Not in any formal way. But I don't think she was afraid of those things. You know, Connie really was a person without borders. I guess that's why I can see that she would be more radical than I gave her credit for at the time. Remember, I was really young,
yeah,
and kind of excitable. she was not ever excitable. Mm-hmm. I was very excitable. But she was a sort of a universal person. It's one of the impressions that I would say right away. She was a person without borders. I could see her comfortable with anyone, anywhere. She was like that. She liked people or she didn't. She took them on their own merit. I don't think she was ever influenced by someone's advertising, but had a good sense of how people really were.
I sit here in this invulnerable silence, and the whole world creeps into my apartment. My floor is not clean of sweat and blood. My mind is riddled with megalomania, the delirium, the paranoia, the hubophrenia that rides the land. My body encloses the germs of the nation. My fate is tinged with the fate of the Bowery bum, the Chrysler worker, and the Georgia cracker. They come in. They creep in. This is their apartment, too. They are like gravitation. I cannot evade them.
There are more twists and turns to this story. What was Connie Converse's connection to the SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society, the rather radical group of the 1960s, as they prepared for their protests at the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago. What was the disconnect between Connie Converse and the avant-garde music scene in Ann Arbor in the 1960s surrounding the Once Festival, featuring artists like Robert Ashley and Gordon Mumma? What was Connie's vast article for the Journal of Conflict Resolution called The War of All Against All? And how did writing that article lead to her need to disappear? And what quote-unquote horrible thing did Connie do to Riley Trumbull, even if it was meant as a kindness? Answers to these questions and more coming up in part two of Connie Converse, Let Me Be If I Can. It'll be available soon as the next episode in the Spinning on Air podcast. I'm David Garland. I produce the podcast. Ann Garland helped me with some editorial comments that helped shape the show. Thanks so much to Riley Trumbull for sharing her thoughts and memories, and to Amber Benson for reading the words of Connie Converse. Thanks to Aaron Dyer and John Zorn for permission to include a portion of Playboy of the Western World from the recent Zodiac CD Vanity of Vanities, featuring the songs of Connie Converse. Go to spinningonair.org for links to more information about some of the topics in this program, and to check out some of the previous episodes of Spinning on Air. This is an independent production, and your support would really make a difference. You can contribute through PayPal or Patreon. More information about supporting Spinning on Air is also at spinningonair.org. Spinning on Air is a registered trademark of WNYC Radio, used by permission. Part two of this story will be available soon. Thanks for listening. Thank you.